Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. This show will first be broadcast on Wednesday, December 10th, 2025, on 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician, with my co-host Ron Meniza. We're coming to you live from beautiful Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, and Buzzsprout. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episodes at Fran Storch ND for 30 days and also on my YouTube channel at Radio Naturopath. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of the station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. So post-surgically, I'm not doing too bad. I'm up to 35 minutes on the indoor bicycle, the regular, regular bicycle. I'm doing Zwift, so I'm doing the indoor virtual rides because it's cold out. And not doing too bad with that. And I'm doing PT exercises, and Will keeps increasing what I'm doing, increasing weight, increasing difficulty of exercises, and giving me more exercises. So I finally said to him, let's split it into day one and day two. So I'm not doing an hour of exercises. So we did, and it makes it so the exercises are plus or minus 30 minutes. So it's not too bad. And I was able to increase some weights on some of the things that I'm doing. So that's nice. I'm doing okay with those. My core seems okay. So that's good. I do still have trouble with the knee. I went to the, I think I talked about this, that I went to the guy to talk about stem cell and PRP. And it sounds like a wonderful program, but it's not within my budget at the moment. So I'm probably going to once I'm all set with my insurance for the new year, I will probably go back to UConn and talk to them about perhaps getting hyaluronic acid or PRP in that knee. Because the knee is, I can brace it and I'm using red light therapy on it, but it's not entirely trustworthy.
So what exactly is PRP?
PRP is platelet-rich plasma, and I've explained this a few times on the show,
okay.
But yeah.
All right.
So platelet-rich plasma is, it's where you spin down, they take a sample of your own blood, and they spin it down, and they take out the white elements, the plasma and the white blood cells and all that, and then they inject it back into you, into the part that they're concerned about. And it's supposed to stimulate healing in the area. The cells go after the tissue, and it stimulates healing. So you might get a little bit of cartilage back. You get a little bit of...
Really?
Yes. Yeah, you get a little bit of lubrication back. And it works. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And I've heard people have it done and have good results with it. So I may do that, but I will probably do it through a place where my insurance covers it.
Right, yeah, exactly. So. I'm sure it sounds expensive.
Yeah. So anyway, so that's what's going on there. I mean, I'm able to walk. I'm able to do most things. I'm not able to walk far or fast, but I can get on the bike, so that's good. My strength is improving on the bike, and my strength is improving with the physical therapy exercises, so that's exciting. So we had Thanksgiving weekend together, and we had a very quiet Thanksgiving because Ron wasn't feeling well. He had a cold, and he's mostly over the cold, although he has a lot of congestion still. I'm starting to wonder if you have a sinus infection.
No, I don't think so.
Okay, he doesn't think he has a sinus infection. It's just the taking that...
There's no color.
Yeah.
When I have a sinus infection, there's color.
Color, and you probably feel a lot worse. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So... and I managed not to catch the cold because we stayed separate for a while when he was most contagious, and I'm doing okay, so that's good. So how are you doing post-surgically?
I'm vertical.
Yeah, you are.
It's my standard response now. Uh-huh. I am vertical, and that's a good thing because vertical is better than horizontal.
Yeah.
And although horizontal is nice at night when you're sleeping.
But yes.
Anyway. So getting better, it's a slow process. It's a very slow process.
Yeah.
And right now I've just got to find out what it is I can actually physically do as far as weight limitations, that sort of thing. And I have an appointment coming up in about a week.
Okay.
Or maybe less than a week. Can't remember. Might even be this week. Can't remember. And, you know, we'll evaluate where I'm at and what my next step is here. Because I don't want to damage anything that has been done here.
Right.
So it's really super important that I don't lift anything super heavy at this point. And I just don't know how long that process is of how long can you not lift weights anymore. Weight being, you know, everyday activity, being, you know, maybe some work in the gym. Definitely some work in the gym. I need to do a lot of that.
Yeah.
And I've been doing, you know, wall sits and other various things. I'm teaching my seniors classes and I've advanced my weights in my seniors classes. So I'm doing okay. It's a slow process.
Yeah.
I want it to be over with.
We want to get out and walk and run.
I want to be like strong like Superman again. And I don't know if I can. I don't know if I can do that at this point in time.
Right.
I did attempt to accomplish the Manchester Road Race this year.
Yes, you did. You did all 4.7 miles.
39th time.
Yeah.
Hello. And so I did that. And, you know, it because I tried to jog a little bit whilst also walking, I've got sore spots. But, you know.
Ah.
But that's, you know, anything you do now, you'll have a sore spot if you haven't been doing it on a regular basis. And I thought I had a pretty good base because I'd come back from Chicago and, you know, Greg and I walked 18 miles in 3 days. So
I thought
I was going to be good. But just
that. But you jogged. That's what happened.
Additional bouncing and jogging and impacting is you feel it. You definitely feel it.
When was the last time you had run or jogged?
Well, I've done a little bit, but not much.
Right.
I mean, it's been, you know, just like run to the mailbox and back or something like that. But that's all there was really.
That's barely
there.
Anything. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not really anything at all. So, yeah, there's that. And I haven't had any opportunity to climb, you know, decent sized hills or anything like that on my bike. So, you know.
And there's a great big hill in the Manchester Road Race.
A great big hill, almost a mile long hill in the Manchester Road Race.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was an accomplishment to get over it, I'll say. So, I was starting to feel like all the other people out there.
Right.
Entirely like myself.
That's not an easy hill to get up for anybody. I mean, everything slows way down once you're on that hill, and you're so glad to see the Island Park Market when you get to it.
Yeah,
and everybody's there clapping for you, and I think at the top of the hill that's where the bagpipes are.
Right after the Highland Park Market.
They're
usually before it, but they weren't this year, and I thought they weren't going to be there, and then I got around that crowd, and then there they were.
Yeah. I saw Safety Man.
I finished with Safety Man.
Oh, you did?
Pretty close to Safety Man, because I heard him being announced as I was coming in.
Yeah. He was telling everybody to be safe.
Be safe, yeah.
Yeah.
And everyone was really safe, so it was good. Although, I did see one casualty on the run. And I'm not really sure what was going on, but he was being attended to by the professionals.
Yeah. So. Oh. Right.
Yeah, things like that can happen.
They sure can.
It's not an unusual thing to have. And when you have 12,000 people to have somebody, you know, pull up with a problem.
Right. Well, and the thing is, a lot of people don't train for the Manchester Road Race. They just go do it because it's Thanksgiving
because
Day.
It's the thing you do on Thanksgiving
and
Day.
And they may not be trained and they may push themselves too hard. So shout out to Bill who's listening to us. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Bill.
So great. So we got a good rest this weekend. I think I'm rested up for the week. We'll see. All right. So let's talk about Japanese fitness walking, which is, it's kind of exciting. I just heard about it. So it's this neat low impact exercise. So here's what it is. It's interval walking training. It's a form of walking exercise that was developed by Japanese researchers to improve cardiometabolic health. And it's also known as Japanese walking. It's abbreviated IWT. It's accessible. It's great for any age and fitness level. Compared to traditional walking, individuals who did IWT showed greater improvements in blood pressure, BMI, body mass index, blood glucose, and more. So you can take your walking regimen to the next level. It's a simple way to safely ramp up intensity and reap significant health benefits. Japanese walking. Interval walking training was developed by Japanese researchers to improve the cardiometabolic health of older adults. And it's different from high-intensity interval training. Interval walking training is a form of interval training that's accessible for people of all ages and fitness levels. Study specifically looking at the benefits of interval walking training have found improved physical fitness, muscle strength, and glycemic control. And this was studied by Mass General Brigham Sports Medicine. So interval walking training is a great way to meet the recommended 150 minutes of a week of moderate intensity aerobic activity. So the difference between high-intensity interval training and interval walking training, high-intensity interval training involves alternating between periods of lower intensity exercise or rest and higher intensity exercise for a predetermined number of sets. Intensity is typically gauged through heart rate or subjective measures like rate of perceived exertion. When you push the intensity, you can get the same health benefits with less time at the gym. While it's considered generally safe, some research has shown that high-intensity exercise may lead to training-related injuries. Interval walking training, or Japanese walking, on the other hand, dials down the intensity is generally considered safe. According to the original research in Japanese walking published in the Mayo Clinic Proceedings in 2009, the standard interval walking training protocol, see, this has been going on since at least 2009, and I didn't know about it, and I'm just finding out about it now. It consists of alternating intervals of 3 minutes of fast walking, about 70% of peak aerobic capacity. So 70% of max is not as hard as 85% of max or what you might do for high intensity interval training. So you will get your benefits if you go up to 70% max, which is going to be, you're going to be glowing, but you'll still be able to talk probably. And then 3 minutes of slow walking, which is 40% of max. So you just walk slowly until your heart rate comes down. And the minimum recommended is 5 sets of intervals. It amounts to 30 minutes of walking 5 days a week. So that's very accessible for a lot of people. 70% max is not bad. You have to figure out what your max heart rate is, and then you go to 70% of that, and you have to have a way to measure your heart rate if you want to do it that way. If you don't, but and you also can measure your heart rate and then see what that feels like, and then once you get a sense of what that is, you don't necessarily have to always measure your heart rate if you don't want to. But a lot of people like numbers, so they have their, you know, they have their watches and their fitness apps and their heart rate monitors and stuff like that. So if you're into that, that there's this is a way to do it. You can also download a timer. There's a timer that you can put on your phone that will that you can set intervals, and it will ding you when an interval is when you have to change an interval. So I found one for Android because I have an Android phone, and you can set up any sort of interval session that you want. So you can set up this 3 minute, you know, you hit it start and it sets up and it'll ding you at every three minutes to change your interval. So the minimum recommended 5 sets of intervals amounts to 30 minutes of walking, and you do it 5 days a week. For the study, the Japanese researchers recruited over 200 adults with an average age of 63 to test how interval walking training fared against traditional continuous intensity walking, and found that it was superior to traditional walking for various health markers, including blood pressure, blood sugar, body mass index, aerobic capacity, and strength. So just as important as those health benefits, the protocol was something the participants could stick with long term. And then another analysis found that almost 800 of 826 subjects were found to follow the interval walking training for the study duration. There was a 95% adherence rate, which is very good. There was a 2024 review of interval walking training that concluded that its health benefits were well established both in middle and older aged but otherwise healthy individuals and individuals with metabolic diseases. Compared to energy expenditure and time duration match continuous walking training, interval walking training is superior for improving physical fitness, body composition, and glycemic control with people with type 2 diabetes. So that was stated by Christian Karstoff, who's the first author of Review and Consultants and clinical associate professor in Copenhagen. So to get started with Japanese walking, no matter what your fitness level or goals, Japanese walking can be a great way to start a new fitness regimen or step up your game with an existing one. It's also important to practice interval walking training correctly, and a good idea to check with your doctor before you do. Make sure you're comfortable when you're doing your exercises. Because you want to feel like you're comfortable, and so that means where you're doing it, the location, whether you're indoors or outdoors, whether your clothes are comfortable, whether you have good shoes. You don't want to start working out too hard or too intensely. So here's some tips to get started with interval walking training. Start with attainable goals. If you can't do 30 minutes when you first start, that's fine. Choose a goal that works for your fitness level. So if you're not able to do the 5 sets of 3 minutes hard, 3 minutes off, start with 1 or 2. And then work your way up. I mean, that's what I'm doing with my time on the bike. I'm increasing my load by 5 minutes a week. I'm having longer minutes, but I'm increasing it gradually. So during your fast walking intervals, you should only be able to say a few words before catching your breath. You want to wear supportive walking shoes. If you're not comfortable, you're less likely to stick to your routine. So make sure the shoes don't hurt when you're walking with them. Make sure you know your body, and if you feel pain or dizziness, slow down or stop. Track your sessions using a journal or fitness tracker. It's always fun to see what you did. It's fun to have a record of what you did, because then you can look back at it and you can feel proud of what you did, and you can also see how you increase, how you may increase your heart rate in that faster interval. And you just want to see how you feel, and you could take notes about how you felt, because most of the fitness trackers, there's a place for you to take notes and say how it went and how you feel. If you want to go on interval walk and do an interval walking training program, start low, build slowly. Walk your regular pace for a few minutes, then walk briskly for 20 to 30 seconds and repeat for the duration of your walk. As your body adapts to the new exercise stimulus, you can gradually increase the duration of faster walking bouts. So that's the other thing. You don't have to start with 3 minutes on, 3 minutes off. You can start with 30 seconds on, 30 seconds off, and work your way up to 3 minutes on, 3 minutes off. And you have to realize you're not in a race and you have time. And you will get to 3 minutes on, 3 minutes off. Or maybe you won't, but that's okay. I find that when I do something consistently, I definitely am able to progress if I am consistent with what I do. And you probably will be able to do that as well. So it's really, and if you want more information about Japanese interval walking training, you can go onto YouTube, and there's a lot of YouTubes that explain it. So that's interesting. So I thought it would be an interesting thing to talk about. It's something that Ron could do in his fitness class. He could spend, if he wanted to, you could spend 30 minutes doing Japanese interval walking training. Your class would probably like it, especially if you put fun music on. That's the other thing you should know about this. If it's crummy weather out, you can do it indoors. You can walk around your house. You can march. You can step side to side. And you can go onto YouTube, and there are people who will guide you through a Japanese walking training class. So, and they'll guide you through for the 5 minutes. Oh, what is that? There's an app. There's this dedicated app for Japanese walking training.
Yeah, there's probably many, but
and there's probably many, them, but yeah. Ron found one, and that he found that in the Apple App Store. So if you go ahead and look in in Google Play, you'll probably find one for Android as well. So, yeah. So that's an exciting thing. So consider Japanese walking training. If you've been sitting around, you haven't been doing a lot of cardio, this is a great way to get started. It's very simple. It's not super intense, and there's a lot of health benefits to it. And, you know, for me, who I'm recovering from surgery, it's a nice thing to start. And I did a couple of classes with the very cute Aiko and April from Yes to Next on YouTube. And they're into Japanese walking training. So I did a couple of classes with them, and they're very cute because, you know, it's a mother and daughter. Mom is 83 and April is my age, around 61. And so the two of them exercise together, and they banter with each other, and the mom is really funny. She comes out with a lot of, she says a lot of funny things, and she's 83 years old, and it's great. So even when you're in your 80s, you can do stuff like this. Okay. So one of the things that we have found is that you get somewhat more health benefits. You know how we were saying that there's exercise snacks? When you do exercise snacks that, you know, so say you do 5 minutes to 10 minutes at a time of exercise and you do a bunch of those through the day, by the end of the day, you'll get 30 to 40 minutes in, and that's great. It is great. It's still great. So I don't want you to think it's not great, because if that's what you can manage, that's what you can do. What's the best exercise for you?
The one you'll do.
That's right, the one you'll do. However, there's new research that says it's not about as much about steps as it is about stamina. So there's new research that looks into the importance of walking bouts in addition to step count when it comes to heart health. People who take less than 5,000 steps a day or walk in bouts of 5 minutes or less are more likely to have heart disease, according to the findings. Cardiologists explain walking habits for a healthy heart. And so the great step count debate continues. Over recent years, researchers have examined the possible health impacts of 4,000 daily steps, 7,000 steps, short exercise snacks, and other amounts of movement to answer the overarching question of how much exercise exactly does it take to stay healthy? The latest study under the umbrella examines people who took less than 8,000 steps, how they took them in short or long bursts, and what that cadence meant for cardiovascular health. Ultimately, researchers found that walking longer bouts significantly cuts cardiovascular disease and all-cause mortality risk. So, cardiologists explain the conclusions in an attempt to settle the step saga as it pertains to heart health, at least. So the study found, researchers looked at accelerometer, that's step counters, data from over 33,000 people in the United Kingdom who took 8,000 or fewer daily steps and were initially free of cardiovascular disease or cancer. They were categorized into sedentary participants who had fewer than 5,000 daily steps and low active participants who had 5,000 to 7,999 daily steps. Not 8,000. Over an average of 7.9 years, researchers tracked participants' health and learned that people who took most of their daily steps in longer bouts, between 10 and 15 minutes at a time, had lower all-cause death rates and lower risk of developing cardiovascular disease compared to those who took their steps in shorter durations. Those conclusions were much more prominent in the sedentary group. As with most studies, this one has its limitations. The findings are observational and also contain implicit bias, as people who tend to take longer walks may also make healthier choices, notes Mary Green, who's a cardiologist with Manhattan Cardiology in New York City. However, the findings do suggest that sustained activity over 10 or more minutes may be necessary to stimulate the cardiovascular and metabolic benefits of activity that doesn't occur in 5 minutes or less. Most importantly, the research further emphasizes the danger of sedentary behavior. It also suggests that the spacing of activity, even in those who are very sedentary, is related to the degree of cardiovascular risk. Why longer walks work? Longer or more continuous walking raises your heart rate and cardiac output in a more sustained way, which trains the heart and improves cardiovascular fitness more so than small bursts of activity. This sustained activity also improved insulin sensitivity and lipid metabolism in study participants, which can reduce cardiovascular risk factors like diabetes and atherosclerosis. So which advice is right? You may be thinking, what about exercise snacks or past research that says that even short, small bursts of activity are helpful? Well, those aren't necessarily wrong. Both exercise snacks and sustained activity are good for health. Something is always better than nothing. That's what I just basically said. Sustained activity is better. Adding snacks to a regimen of sustained activity is best. So the important message to take away from these findings is that taking less than 4,000 steps a day is detrimental, and if you can get in at least around 7,000, that appears to be the well-studied average on-ramp to cardiovascular benefits. The reality is the longer bouts of activity that this research suggests won't happen by accident and will likely take some planning. That may mean scheduling 10 minutes to walk with a coworker during lunch or incorporating a walk as part of a daily routine. You can even intentionally take the longer route to get somewhere or park further out in a parking lot. You can write it in your calendar and hold yourself to it. Couple it to something enjoyable to make it more attractive. Walk to your favorite coffee shop or call your friend. If you miss a day, don't let it set you back and squeeze some steps in where you can. Anything is better than nothing. So here we are telling you, really, it's only going to benefit you if you do it for at least 10 to 15 minutes. But so you just kind of give up. You don't have to give up. You still do your short bursts if that's all you can manage. If you're sedentary, you can start slow with a general increase in activity, like taking the stairs. Start to aim for at least 7,000 steps a day as you build up endurance. Then start sustained walking sessions with a pace that's comfortably uncomfortable. In other words, do your best to get your heart rate up and work your way up to 10 minutes of that. If you can, add some resistance training or body weight exercises as well, which can also provide other health benefits. Consistency is key. It's more important to be consistent with moving your body than it is to be perfect. Don't let perfect be the enemy of good. So that's very interesting. So yeah, you're going to get apparently more health benefits if you do sustained exercise, but that sustained exercise is 10 to 15 minutes. So if you can walk for 10 to 15 minutes most days a week, that you're going to get some health benefits from that. And if you add in the Japanese fitness walking, where you do the 3 minutes on, 3 minutes off, and the 3 minutes on is only 70% max. And right. So I invite you to get a heart rate monitor so you can figure out what your 70% max is.
And they are readily affordable these days.
Yeah.
They're not,
right.
They're not like they used to be. So, and really, you know, the maximum at that 70% range, 30 minutes is all you really need. 30 minutes is not a lot of time.
Right. Well, it depends. I mean, it just depends on what people are doing. People's lives are complicated.
To put it into regular good old American terms, it's five times sitting in a McDonald's drive-thru per week.
Oh, dear.
So 30 minutes is not a huge commitment.
The other thing is that you want to make sure that you have a place to exercise, inside your home. Like right now, this time of year, you don't always want to get outside because the weather's not doing well for you. So you want to be able to do this kind of exercise inside your house. You want to also be able to do it outdoors, and you want to do it. Want to be have a place to do it outdoors, but away from your house, but indoors. Mm-hmm. So it is possible to do, because I find that, you know, I have to prioritize sleep because I get very tired from my work days. So I have to make sure that I have plenty of sleep before and after my work days. So you know, but for the last 5 years, I have not been, it hasn't been useful for me to get up in the morning and go out somewhere to exercise. I have to exercise inside or outside of my home. And that makes it so I can sleep longer. And so I have to prioritize that. So that's why I make sure that I can exercise inside my home. So if I wanted to do the Japanese interval walking, I would do it in front of my TV with a class and do it in my bedroom and out the hall and back and stuff like that. And that's why I also have the bike trainer downstairs. Or I could do it from the house. I could walk out my front door and do a walk. If the weather's nice, I can do it out from my front door. So that's how I do it. However you set up your exercise, you want to make it as easy for yourself as possible. So make it as easy for yourself as possible. Don't be discouraged by the fact that it's a good idea for you to work up to getting a longer bout of exercise and do what you can. But it's just that the science is showing that you want to exercise steadily for about 10 to 15 minutes. So, all right. So that's the long walk instead of, longer bouts instead of snacks. Still do the snacks. Do what you can do. All right. So Ron and I were talking about the five essential Japanese morning exercises. So I looked up what those were. And here they are. So number one is the sumo stance. So what that is, it's basically a wide plié. You put your legs as wide as you comfortably can, and then you sit into them. And you stand stand in that stance for, you know, a minute or two. And it's basically, you know, legs separated wide and sit into it. And you go down as low as is comfortable for you. And you'll find that over time, you'll be able to sit lower and lower. But do it at a level that works for you. And if you do it, if you need to start by doing it on a chair, you can do it that way too. Sit at the edge of a chair and put your legs down that way. So you want it to be on sort of a low stool so you get some benefit and you can lift yourself off a little bit of the chair and sit down if you need to. But anyway, so the sumo stance is the first one and it helps you with strength. The second exercise is cat stance. So cat stance, you start with one leg. You could start with your right leg and you sit back on it and your front leg is turned in front of you and your knees are bent. So your legs are separated. It's hard to describe. Your legs are separated from each other like you're walking, like you have one step walking in front of the other leg and you sit into that. You put more weight on the back leg than the front leg and you can pick that front leg up and down and that helps you with balance. So you do it on one side and then you do it on the other side and you practice that for a while. And number three is seiza. So seiza, I didn't know the word seiza until I started doing yin yoga with Debbie Daly, and Debbie Daly would use the term seiza. And I didn't know what that was. And apparently it's a Japanese term. And it's when you sit kneeling. So you kneel and you sit on your pointed feet. And that's how you sit. So you're in a kneeling stance. That would be very hard for me because it's hard on my knees. So there's ways to do that. If you can't do it straight, you know, with you with kneeling, with sitting on the backs of your heels, with your feet pointed, a couple things I've done is I've put a block or a cushion or both between my rear and my feet, and I sit on that, and then I'm able to do it. And another way, if you can't sit in seiza with your knees back, like with your feet back like that, then you just sit cross-legged. And the idea is to sit in that position and sit with a straight spine and breathe and and it works your core. And so it's one of the exercises that's very good for your core. So that's seiza. Then number four is zazen. Basically, you're sitting in either seiza, in some kind of seiza. You can sit, again, you can sit on your heels or you can sit cross-legged. And you basically sit there and breathe. And that's it. And it's basically a meditation. And you do that for 2 to 5 minutes or longer if you like, but at least 2 to 5 minutes. So that's zazen, and it comes from the practice of Zen meditation. And number five is the wall sit. So the wall sit, the optimal is you do 10 bouts of 20 seconds, and you can, and ideally when you do the wall sit, you want you're leaning your back with a straight spine against the wall and your legs are sitting at a 90 degree angle. So if that's too much for you, I think that at this point it's too much for me because my knees can't handle it at this point. Then you start within a obtuse angle. You don't go down as low as 90 degrees. Go down to a level that works for you that you can manage for 20 seconds. And if you can't manage 20 seconds, do what you can. And then you do 10 of those. And if you can't do 10, you do less. So you work up, the idea is to work up to 10 bouts of 20 seconds at 90 degrees. But that's the optimal, and you work up to it. Do whatever you can. If you have to do, 3 times 10 seconds or 3 times 5 seconds, then do that. That's fine. And if you can't do 90 degrees, do whatever bend in the knee that you can do. And if you want to, you can work up to 1 to 3 minutes of wall sit. And you can also place a ball between your knees, one of those exercise balls. Not a medicine ball, not a heavy ball, but a light ball that's a little squishy. And you put that between your knees and squeeze it. And that gives you, the wall sits are incredible because they give you strength, balance, breath, posture, and control. So those are the 5 essential Japanese morning exercises. The sumo stand for strength, the cat stance for balance, seiza, so where you kneel and sit on your feet, Or you can sit cross-legged. Zazen, which is sitting in that stance and breathing and meditating if you want to. And then the wall sit, which helps with everything. Strength, balance, posture, and control. And then there's, so there's that. Now, I wanted to talk some about red light therapy. So red light therapy, red light therapy has been gaining attention as a non-invasive treatment that can provide potential wellness benefits. You can enhance your skin health and alleviate pain, and it's an innovative therapy that's making waves, because it's waves of light, right, in the healthcare community. And why is it garnering such interest? Red light therapy involves exposing the skin to low levels of red or near-infrared light. Unlike ultraviolet light, which can damage the skin, red light therapy is considered safe and beneficial. The process is simple. A device emits red light over a targeted area. It uses wavelengths of light to penetrate the skin's layers. The wavelengths stimulate cellular processes as the cells absorb this light energy, leading to various healing effects. So, red light therapy enhances wellness and recovery. To understand how it works, it's important to know a bit about how cells function. Mitochondria, which are often referred to as the powerhouses of cells, produce energy. When mitochondria absorb red light, they work better. That boosts energy production in the cells, which can promote regeneration. Red light therapy can also help lower oxidative stress or an imbalance of free radicals and antioxidants in the body. The process can harm cells and lead to aging and disease. By minimizing oxidative stress, red light therapy supports the body's natural therapeutic processes. So this therapy technique is known for promoting healing, reducing inflammation, and enhancing skin cells, and it helps to stimulate the body's natural healing process. It can help to improve, so there's those ads on TV for those funny red light masks, because it can help to promote your skin health and can help to reduce the appearance of fine lines, skin pigmentation, and promote a more youthful complexion. The therapy stimulates collagen production, which is a key protein that keeps skin firm and elastic. Red light therapy can also help heal acne and reduce scars, which makes it a great choice for people wanting healthier looking and feeling skin. For the face, the therapy can help reduce signs of aging and improve skin texture. Many people incorporate cosmetic services like red light therapy into their skincare routine for its rejuvenating effects. It's known for its ability to improve skin tone, reduce wrinkles, and decrease the appearance of scars and blemishes. It also promotes collagen production, which can lead to firmer, more youthful-looking skin. It also can help with pain relief and muscle recovery. Red light therapy is also used for pain relief, and muscle recovery can help reduce chronic pain like arthritis by lowering inflammation and increasing blood flow to the affected areas. Athletes often use red light therapy to speed up recovery times and reduce muscle soreness after workouts. Another benefit of red light therapy is improved circulation or blood flow. This helps deliver more oxygen and nutrients to tissues. As a result, healing and recovery happen faster. This can be particularly beneficial for individuals with circulatory issues or those recovering from injuries. Emerging research suggests that red light therapy may have positive effects on mental health. It can help reduce symptoms of depression and anxiety by affecting serotonin production. Serotonin is a neurotransmitter that helps create feelings of well-being and happiness. When you use red light therapy, it's very simple. There are devices available for professional and at-home use. Professional treatments are typically administered by healthcare providers or in special clinics, while at-home devices range from handheld gadgets to full-body panels. You can get medical skin care experts that offer powerful results, as they often use higher-intensity devices. Red light therapy is offered by various services. So if you're looking for an at-home device, it's important to choose one that's safe and effective. Look for devices that emit wavelengths between 600 and 900 nanometers, as those are considered optimal for therapeutic effect. Follow the manufacturer's instructions for use. Red light therapy is generally considered safe for most individuals. It's non-invasive and does not use UV light, which can damage the skin. However, as with any treatment, it's important to use it correctly and follow safety guidelines. Some people may experience mild side effects, such as temporary redness or irritation. It's a good idea to talk to a healthcare professional before starting a new treatment, especially if you have various health conditions or are pregnant. So red light therapy offers a range of benefits from enhancing skin health to promoting recovery and well-being. Whether you're looking to improve your complexion, alleviate pain, or boost your mental health, it could be worth considering. So I have a red light device that goes around my knee, and I'm trying to use it most days for 15 minutes at a time. And I'm hoping that's going to help with my to help to heal my knees. So it's very interesting because it's so non-invasive. You can control the heat level on the devices usually. So if you're not tolerating the heat, you can set it to high or low, and it can be really helpful. So, all right. So that's red light therapy. So we've got this is a power-packed episode because we've got a lot of things to talk to you about. Let's see. So then there's I wanted to talk about dehydration. I had an article come across my desk about dehydration and anxiety. So you hear me talking about hydration all the time, and you see me hydrating on the show. So anyway, so dehydration can fuel anxiety and health problems. And this came from Liverpool John Moores University. And the summary was that not drinking enough water could intensify stress responses. Researchers found that underhydrated individuals had cortisol levels more than 50% higher during stressful situations. Poor hydration didn't make participants feel thirstier, but it did trigger biological signs of strain. Keeping a water bottle handy could help manage stress and safeguard health. So, underhydration boosts cortisol, the stress hormone, raising risks for chronic conditions. Staying well hydrated may help the body handle stress more effectively. Drinking too little water could increase our vulnerability to stress-related health issues, according to this new study from this Liverpool John Moores University. So people who drink less than the recommended daily fluid intake experience a greater stress hormone response, which is associated with an increased risk of heart disease, diabetes, and depression. A new study, which was published recently in the Journal of Applied Physiology, found that individuals who drank less than 1.5 liters of fluid, or 7 cups of tea per day, had a cortisol response to stress that was over 50% higher than those who met daily water intake recommendations. So the study lead professor, Neil Walsh, who is a physiologist in that school's sport and exercise sciences, said cortisol is the body's primary stress hormone. An exaggerated cortisol reactivity to stress is associated with an increased risk of heart disease, diabetes, and depression. If you know you have a looming deadline or speech to make, keep a water bottle close. Keeping a water bottle close is a good idea and a good habit with potential benefits for your long-term health. With the project funded by Danone R&I, Neil and his team divided healthy young adults into two equally sized groups, representing the lowest and highest 25% for daily fluid intake. The low fluid group consisted of individuals who typically drank less than 1.5 liters of fluids a day. The high fluid group included individuals who regularly met the daily water intake recommendations, 2 liters for women and 2.5 liters for men. Both groups were matched for key factors known to influence stress responses, such as psychological characteristics and sleep. Participants maintained that their usual drinking habits for 1 week, during which hydration levels were monitored in blood and urine samples. Then participants underwent the Trier social stress test, widely used to simulate real-world stress through a mock job interview and a mental arithmetic test. Dr. Daniel Kashi, a member of the study team, said both groups felt equally anxious and experienced similar increases in heart rate during the stress test. However, only the low fluid group showed a significant increase in saliva cortisol in response to the stress test. Although the low fluid group did not report being thirstier than the high fluid group, they had darker and more concentrated urine, clear signs of poor hydration. An important observation was that poor hydration was associated with greater cortisol reactivity to the stress test. Exaggerated cortisol reactivity to stress has been associated with poor long-term health. So, why is dehydration harmful? I mean, I could go on about this, but we'll see what they say. The body's water regulation system, which is closely connected to the brain stress response center, when the body senses dehydration, whether due to inadequate fluid intake or excessive fluid loss, it triggers the release of a hormone called vasopressin. Vasopressin also known as antidiuretic hormone. It acts primarily on the kidneys, promoting water reabsorption to maintain blood volume and electrolyte balance. This conservation mechanism comes at a cost. Sustained vasopressin release places additional strain on the kidneys, which must work harder to concentrate urine and manage electrolyte balance. Vasopressin also acts on the brain's stress response center, the hypothalamus, where it can influence the release of cortisol. The dual role for vasopressin helps maintain blood volume and electrolyte balance, but also increases cortisol. The researchers say that while further long-term studies are needed, the findings reinforce current water intake recommendations, approximately 2 liters of fluid each day for women and 2.5 for men. Hydration helps us manage stress. Being hydrated may help your body to manage stress more effectively, adds Dr. Kashi. A practical way to check your hydration status is to monitor your urine color. Light yellow typically indicates good hydration. If you know, for example, you have a stressful schedule, maybe a looming deadline or speech to make, keeping a water bottle close by could be a good habit for potential benefits for long-term health. So my habit is I always have water nearby. As you can see, you can always see me sipping on water during my shows. And when I'm at the office, I always have a water bottle on my desk. If I run out of water and I can't, and I'm in the middle of a patient, I contact my staff and they bring me more water. And I just always make sure I have water on hand. And dehydration is serious. And if you have autonomic issues, my autonomic nervous system is rather sensitive. I'm going to stay calmer if I'm well hydrated. So I've learned that over time, and I just make sure that I have a lot of fluids around that I want to drink. So stay hydrated. Hydrate or die, as Evan Johnson, my friend and professor, used to say. So, all right, so that's hydration. Now, here's another surprising. Sleepless nights may raise your risk of dementia.
Duh.
Right, exactly. So this came from the American Academy of Neurology. Chronic insomnia may do more than leave you groggy. It could speed up brain aging. A large Mayo Clinic study found that people with long-term sleep troubles were 40% more likely to develop dementia or cognitive impairment, with brain scans showing changes linked to Alzheimer's. Those reporting reduced sleep showed declines comparable to being 4 years older, while certain genetic risk carriers saw even steeper drops. So struggling with insomnia might put the brain on a faster track to aging, dementia, and memory decline. Researchers found that poor sleep was tied to brain changes and test scores equivalent to years of extra aging. So chronic insomnia, which is trouble sleeping at least 3 days a week for 3 months or more, could speed up brain aging. People with chronic insomnia were 40% more likely to develop dementia or mild cognitive issues than people without insomnia. Insomnia with perceived reduced sleep was associated with lower cognition comparable to being 4 years older. Better sleep isn't just beauty rest. It might protect your brain health. So people with chronic insomnia may experience faster declines in memory and thinking skills as they age, along with brain changes that can be seen on imaging scans, than people who do not have chronic insomnia, according to a study published in the September 10th, 2025 issue of Neurology. The study found that people with chronic insomnia, trouble sleeping at least 3 days a week for 3 months or more, had a 40% higher risk of developing mild cognitive impairment or dementia than those without insomnia, which is the equivalent of 3.5 additional years of aging. The study does not prove that insomnia causes brain aging, it only shows an association. Insomnia doesn't just affect how you feel the next day, it may impact your brain health over time. This was shown by a researcher at the Mayo Clinic. We saw faster decline in thinking skills and changes in the brain that suggest chronic insomnia could be an early warning sign or even a contributor to future cognitive problems. The study tracked a group of cognitively healthy older adults and over almost 3,000 people with an average age of 70 for an average of 5.6 years. Of participants, 16% had chronic insomnia. At the start of the study, participants were asked whether they had been sleeping more or less than usual during the past 2 weeks. They also took yearly thinking and memory tests, and some had brain scans to look for white matter hyperintensities, areas where small vessel disease may have damaged brain tissue, and for amyloid plaques, a protein that can build up and is linked to Alzheimer's disease. During the study, 14% of the people with chronic insomnia developed mild cognitive impairment or dementia, compared to 10% of those who did not have insomnia. After accounting for factors like age, high blood pressure, use of sleep medications, and a diagnosis of sleep apnea, they found that people with insomnia were 40% more likely to develop mild cognitive impairment or dementia than those without insomnia. They also had faster declines on tests measuring different thinking skills. Among those with insomnia, researchers determined the type, those getting less sleep than usual in the past 2 weeks or those getting more sleep than usual in the past 2 weeks. People who reported getting less sleep than usual were more likely to have lower cognitive test scores at the beginning of the study, comparable to being 4 years older. They also had more white matter hyperintensities and amyloid plaques. For amyloid, the effect was similar to what is seen in people with the APOE4 gene, a known genetic risk factor. People who reported getting more sleep than usual, on the other hand, were more likely to have fewer white matter hyperintensities at the start of the study. Some groups were especially vulnerable. Participants who carry the APOE4 gene, linked to higher Alzheimer's risk, showed steeper declines in memory and thinking skills. Our results suggest that insomnia may affect the brain in different ways, involving not only amyloid plaques, but also small vessels supplying blood to the brain. This reinforces the importance of treating chronic insomnia, not just to improve sleep quality, but potentially to protect brain health as we age. Our results also add to a growing body of evidence that sleep isn't just about rest, it's also about brain resilience. A limitation of the study was that insomnia diagnoses came from medical records, which do not capture undiagnosed cases or reflect how severe symptoms can be. This was a study that was supported by the National Institutes of Health, the GHR Foundation, Mayo Foundation for Medical Education Research, and a grant from the Sleep Number Corporation to the Mayo Clinic. So that's very interesting. So if you don't sleep enough, you're more likely to get dementia. This is not surprising.
No.
So whatever you can do to improve your sleep is a good idea. All right. So let's see. And so let's now find out why naps are good for you. Can a quick snooze help with energy and focus? The science behind power naps. If you need a quick nap, pick-me-up during the day, a power nap can be just the thing to help restore mental clarity and fight off fatigue. Power naps can help boost productivity and improve overall well-being, especially when taken at the right time for the right duration. A power nap is a short nap that lasts anywhere from 10 to 30 minutes. Even though you're only resting for a short period of time, power naps can effectively increase your level of alertness and focus. Power naps allow your body and mind to rest without entering deeper stages of sleep. Once you enter deep sleep, typically about 30 minutes after you fall asleep, you're likely to experience sleep inertia upon waking. Sleep inertia is the drowsy feeling you may get when you wake up, which you may feel temporarily disoriented and are slower to react. And take your body 30 to 60 minutes to recover from sleep inertia. So the benefits of a quick snooze, naps offer several health benefits that can improve your quality of life. There are studies that show that naps can enhance mood, reduce fatigue, and improve alertness. Additional research has found that power naps may help decrease blood pressure and improve heart health, especially when taken in the early afternoon. Power naps may support work performance as well. Researchers at NASA found that pilots who napped 20 to 30 minutes were over 50% more alert and over 30% more proficient at their jobs than pilots who didn't nap. Keeping your power nap to 30 minutes or less will help you to avoid sleep inertia. A shorter nap can also help you bypass some health risks associated with longer naps. For example, a study published in Obesity found that adults who napped longer than 30 minutes were more likely to experience higher blood pressure and blood sugar levels than the people who did not nap. Short nappers did not share the increased risk. Set an alarm to ensure your nap doesn't increase the 30-minute mark. So here's some tips to help you get a nice restorative nap. You want to time it right. Aim to nap in the early afternoon, typically somewhere between 1 and 3 p.m. when your body naturally experiences a dip in energy. Remember, 5-hour energy always talked about that 2:30 feeling. Mm-hmm. Napping too late in the day can interfere with nighttime sleep. That said, the ideal time to nap varies by individual. Some people may benefit from earlier naps depending on what time they go to sleep.
Keep it short. Set an alarm to wake you after 20 to 30 minutes. A short nap will leave you refreshed rather than groggy. Create a cozy environment. Find a quiet, dark, and comfortable space where you won't be interrupted. If you're in a bright or noisy area, consider using an eye mask or earplugs to help you fall asleep later. Listen to your body. Frequently feel the need for a nap. It may be a sign of inadequate nighttime sleep. While a power nap can help boost energy in the short term, make sure you're prioritizing a good night's rest as well. Frequent daytime drowsiness can be a sign of sleep apnea, a common disorder that causes people to stop breathing for short periods or deep sleep. Talk to your doctor if you're regularly sleepy during the day if you're a loud snorer. Finally, napping is not for everyone. Some people may not feel refreshed even after a short nap. In that case, the best approach may be to avoid napping and focus on getting a good night's sleep. So very interesting. I think that's plenty for today. So I'm going to let you go. You've been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am France Dortch, ND, naturopathic physician with my co-host Ron Meniza. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, Buzzsprout, and YouTube. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at France Dortch, ND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores and WHUS.org.